the organizers, thank you. Thank you all for coming. You know, we spent a year trying to put this together, and I'm thrilled that you all came, and I think it's going to be a great couple of days. As Ross said, there's a lot. What I see is a lot of disciplines doing very similar things from their own perspective without a lot of talking to each other. And I, too, coming from economics, started reading papers in psychology and anthropology and some philosophy and then some of the neuroscience. Because from my perspective, security is two very different things. It's a feeling and a reality. And they're different, right? You could feel secure and not be secure, and you can be secure and not know it. And in our discussion, whether it's in technology or in public policy, we tend to use the same word to mean both. And I think we will do a lot better by pulling the two apart, by talking about the difference, when the two converge, when they diverge. I think it's interesting that there is only one word. And whenever I ask people to speak other languages, I get the same answer, that there is only one word for the two concepts. And the answer to me, at least, is when language developed, the two were the same, that feeling and security tended to be isomorphic, that there wasn't a difference. And it's just now that we're starting to see differences due to society or technology or whatever. So from an economic perspective, security is a trade-off, right? You get security by giving up something. You buy a product. You give up time, convenience, some liberties, some public policy decision. So, it's not does this security work, it's is this a good trade-off? And now people seem to have a natural intuition about trade-offs, right? It's part of being alive. You can imagine a rabbit making a fight-or-flight security trade-off, and the rabbits that tend to make this well will tend to reproduce. So you'd expect that as a successful species on the planet, we would be really good at making these trade-offs. So it gets real interesting to look at the places where we're bad at it, right? Where we make the mistakes. And then there's this whole area of cognitive shortcuts, of biases, of brain heuristics that, look at the mistakes we make and why we make them. So maybe people will talk about that later, but the result really is that that feeling and reality get out of whack. You can imagine, and we have names for some of these, right? A false sense of security when your feeling is higher than reality. Or a naivete when reality is, that's the other way. We don't have a name for when feeling is lower than reality. I guess it's paranoia in the extreme case, but there isn't really something in the mild case. We have words from technology, security theater, right? Security that affects the feeling but not the reality. We don't really have a word for security that affects reality but not the feeling. Kind of like what we want the CIA to do, right? They make us safer but then don't tell us about it. So if you think about economics and the market, as they put it this way, if the market drives security, right, if security products are based on a market, and people are making trade-offs. People are making trade-offs based on the feeling and not the reality. Right? So people are making buying decisions, public policy decisions, based on the feeling and not the reality. So if you are selling a policy, a product, some kind of security, something, your goal is to make people feel secure. Now, there are two ways you can do this. One, you can make people actually secure and hope they notice. Or you can make people feel secure and hope they don't notice. Right? Which now gets into the questions of what makes people notice when feeling reality are out of whack? What makes them not notice? What makes them notice when they're together? Right? And there's been research done, people looking at how well there's understanding. Example, certainly, we have a problem with low probability events. There's not enough data for people to notice when feeling and reality don't match. Right? It's like buying asteroid insurance. Well, how do you know if it worked? There's no events. And then there's feelings of cloudy issues. This gets back to cognitive biases, fear, folk beliefs. So you have feeling and reality. Really, you have something, you have a third thing. You have feeling, reality, and model. Right? The reality is the immutable world. The feelings are feelings about it. And the model is some cognitive model we use to make decisions. Now, so for example, the germ theory of disease. None of us have seen a germ, but we have a model by which we will make security trade-offs. Right? So the feeling is based on intuition. The model is based on reasoning. There's some complication. Right? And so further on, where do we get these models? Right? A lot of them come from science. They come from others. Right? Good models tend to come from science. Models come from religion, from folk beliefs, from culture, from elders. I was in South Africa on safari last year, and people who live near Kruger National Park know how to avoid a lion, a leopard, a rhino. They know what to do. They have a model that I don't have coming from New York City, but then I have a model of street smarts that they don't have. Right? This is a model I got really from society. We get models from elected officials, from the media. So terrorism, child kidnapping. Models can come from industry. I've been writing about surveillance cameras, and there's an entire security model on the effectiveness of surveillance cameras coming from people who are trying to sell us surveillance cameras. Right? And now models can be distinct from feelings. Global warming is an example of a model that is very difficult for people because we tend not to have 100-year time frames to view security trade-offs. And of course, as we become more comfortable with something, models become closer to our feelings. You read about electricity and how people felt about it in the turn of the last century. There's a lot of fear because it was a new thing. Maybe compare that to some computer risks today. Right. Other complications, there's the agency problem. There's agenda. You have industries trying to push certain models. And you get some very complicated interactions. An example which I'll use is smoking. Right. 50 years ago, no one knew about the risks of smoking. You actually had a model being pushed by industry, the health benefits of smoking. Right. Science came up with a new model. Industry actually fought back. Belittled researchers, funded their own research, marginalized experts, denied the model. Right? Eventually, over the course of, decades, the new model has been accepted to the point where, our kids think nothing other than smoking is unhealthy. They might do it, but, it's not that they don't believe that it's unhealthy. Right? And so you can compare that to other examples. Secondhand smoke is probably 20 years behind in the same debate. Seatbelts. We talked about it last night among some people. Right? When I was a kid, we all just climbed in the back and climbed on each other. Right? Kids today won't let you drive if you're not wearing a seatbelt. There's a total shift in the model to a model that's closer to security. Airbags is we're in an earlier stage there. ID cards, another example. I think there's a lot of things here to look at cognitive dissonance, how we deal with two different models in our heads. How we change our model, stuff on how feelings can create a model, how September 11th as a singular event can simultaneously create a new security model in the heads of everybody, or how a health scare might do it, or a personal interaction with crime can change people's perceptions. And then really how we get better models. If there's one theme I think is common in a lot of people's research I read who's here is how can we help people make better security trade-offs, better security decisions? How can we give them more accurate models? How can we teach them to ignore their feelings if they contradict the model? What sorts of proxies should they rely on? And we have a lot of examples, right? The pharmaceutical industry, airline security, building codes. We actually, even though this building is nutty, believe the roof won't fall on our heads, right? Because we are trusting the building codes of the state of Massachusetts. Right? Just work on manipulated models. And then how do we fix this? Right? Short-term fixes are to directly make people feel better. Long-term fixes are to actually fix models. But this is hard. Smoking took decades, and that's an easy one. And when I said this feeling, reality, and model, I said reality doesn't move. But in technology, reality moves. So are we living in a world where the reality of security is moving, where the model is chasing reality, where feeling is chasing the model, and they'll never catch. I mean, are we getting to the point where we can't expect people to make smart security trade-offs? So these are the things I'm thinking about, you know, coming into this. I welcome you, and I look forward to an exciting couple of days. So Ross, first panel.
Great, thanks, Bruce. Now, the format for this workshop, we reckon that the main thing was to let everybody get to know each other and what each other's concerns were and research directions. So we've organized it, as you see, as 8 panels of 5 people. As you can also see, we're fairly tight for space in here, and so we're doing a little bit of hot desking. You know, when the next panel comes up, that will free up enough spaces for the people who are now on the panel. Without further ado about housekeeping, I think we should move into the first panel. And our first speaker, Paul Ekman, is very welcome. He's kind of created the scientific study of deception, and I'm sure that many of us have read some of his writings. Paul.
Thank you. I just go into my room. Okay. No? Got to get this off. And put this onto it. Can you do that?
Sure. There's more than one type of these Mac adapters, unfortunately.
Yes. Can I just ask if I would prefer not to have photographs taken or recordings made? I can do my normal twitching and.
Now, the second speaker is from the security economics community and has also done a lot of work on security usability, Gene Cannon.
So, pardon? No, I'm fine. I'm just slow. But since I'm slow, I'd like to say thank you, Ross, and thank you for putting this together. I appreciate it very much, and thank you for including me. Oh, let's start with the first slide. I want to talk about how computer security deception is different from other perception. And I want to say we've got to bring in the naive, that most people who can't handle themselves on the net can handle themselves in other risk situations. And I want to, and I've been trying to leverage this. And I know that there are many of you, of course, George, it's tremendously intimidating to give this talk in front of you, but and enable them to align it with their mental models and enable them to use their own information. So we have this model in computer security of standalone warnings, and you can see they're all profoundly socially meaningful, if you can figure out what they mean. But they're standalone warnings. They're isolated, and you have to educate people about what they mean. We have other examples of standalone warnings, some of which work. If you look at this, it says, take with food, it doesn't say, it doesn't give you the chemical composition, right? It just says take with food. It doesn't say why, it just tells you how to deal with it. Smoking kills, that's pretty clear. That's much better than any of the security warnings we have. And you'll catch yourself on fire and blow yourself up is probably pretty clear across multiple cultures. So the thing is, these are really physical risks, so they're inherently scary. So one of the things we do in computer security is try to make it scary. We talk about crimes. We talk about demilitarized zones. We talk about infections and worms, ooh, right, and gates and controls. But then when it comes down to it, we're still left with some pretty bad information. And if you look at the information that you get in other places, in other contexts, you get a lot of social information. even though these are very different places in terms of trust, you would probably feel comfortable in them. Why is that? Because there's a lot of other people there. I know that there is a joke among the dominant gender in this audience that women travel in packs. And in fact, you do when you're in college and high school, because it's a safety device. You go out together, and at the beginning of the night, you decide whether or not you're coming home together. Right? So, and these are inherently scary places. I love this picture of the lone car, right, at night. Who wants to go out and get in that car by themselves? There's so much wealth of information here, but most of the information is about what other people are or are not doing. They're either, I mean, this is a place, can you see that? It's like in a completely scary, abandoned street. People aren't taking care of their houses, and they're certainly not going outside. So one of the things I'm really interested in is how to give people this kind of context. And here's another kind of context. Here's a you can pick which bank you want to go to, right? And you can just look at these and know what kind of risk profile you have. Now, you guys, this group can just look at these and know what kind of risk profile you have. But why is that? Well, there's this tiny little icon that's embedded that says, oh, this is less risky than a lot of other places, right? So one of the things I've tried to do is get security to be a social function. That is, to give people access to their own information without requiring that they give it to a third party. Because you can find out where all your friends are browsing, but only if they give it to Dig, so that they give it, you know, to everybody. That there's this kind of trade-off about using your own information. So I came up with this toolbar, which if you know me, you have seen. And it has the little throwing up person. And throwing up isn't good in any culture. I don't care what people said about high school in the 80s. And then happy people. And, you know, I looked at different kind of sources of user-centered information, right? I mean, so there's delicious. It requires making all the information public. Google can help me search because they have all my information and social network, but I can't utilize it for myself. I can't choose to share part of my, you know, my Google history with Matt without saying, oh, here's my password. So I thought this was great, and I was doing absolutely the right thing, and I was building community, and I showed it to a bunch of undergraduates, and they said, this is great. We really like being able to control our information. And then I showed it to one of the groups I'm interested in elders, is because if I wanted to steal money, I would steal money from the baby boomers, not the college students. Who has the money, right? It's the Willie Sutton principle of crime. So I showed this to, we have a relationship with a retirement community, and they were just like, not the box, not the pop-up box, get it away. And they didn't really care what it said. The whole interaction was, you have to take care of this. So one of the things we tried to do is bring it into the physical world. And you can see this is our trust form. Isn't that great? And it can be green if the reputation site is bad, and it can be red if it's good. It turns out we can't actually have a trust orb because the orb is patented, but we can have a trust cube. So, and the nice thing about the cube is you can combine the ratings. You can have the red side and the black side light up at the same time. And we still had some very interesting interactions with this older group about where their risk was. We would say, well, suppose you're doing your online bank account, or suppose you're doing your online brokerage account, and they would say, I don't have an online bank account. I get my bank statement with a piece of paper. I don't have an online brokerage account. I get my bank statement from a piece of paper. And when they sent me the activation code, I just threw it away, right? The idea is because I haven't interacted with it on the computer, nobody else can. That it's this, you know, it's this scary world that's over there that we don't have to deal with. So that is very much what I'm interested in now, trying to get particularly non-traditional user groups, particularly that non-traditional user group that has all the money on the online bank accounts, to look at deception and fraud and to try to use the people they trust. Like you said, who do we trust? Do they trust Bruce? Well, Bruce is a, you know, scary technical globe-trotting, you know, ponytail. Yes, and facial hair. You're scary. Nobody's gonna trust you. So how do you integrate their mental models and their trust behaviors with indicators and make those indicators reliable? I think that that's a huge challenge because, I mean, we have the underlying tools. Knowing the physics was not what enabled this amazing conference room. And I'd really like lunch to descend. Wouldn't that be cool? It was also a certain amount of artistry and innovation. And I think that we know how buildings stand up now. I think that I'm scared of Matt. But I think we know how the buildings stand up now. We have the fundamentals in computer security, and we need to try to bring something more to it. And that's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane. Right, our next speaker, Uri Simonsson, has got a couple of relevant qualifications. Firstly, he's got a background in behavioral economics. And secondly, he's a business school. He works with ops management and information systems. So,
hold that one on.
You can just work. You could just. Sorry, is that yours?
Did a litter. Sorry about that.
All right, there you are.
Simonsson, a behavioral economist, and so I don't usually work on security, although fortunately enough, between the moment I was invited until now, I have been working on a project that has to do with security. And I'm at Wharton until today, and tomorrow I start at UC San Diego, so this conference was particularly challenging in terms of the bureaucracy involved with being reimbursed. Okay, and so I'm going to talk about a specific paper, which is the one you see right there. Do retracted safety ratings linger? Evidence from a consumer report. Oops. So here's some background from the experimental / psychology literature. People can't ignore information that they have. If they have that information and they think they should ignore it, they're told to ignore it, they can't. So you give people anchors, numerical anchors. You tell them, ignore this number. Give me it. How long is this river? You'll be influenced by that anchor. Once they have some information and they want to know what they would have predicted, had they not had that information, they can't, they're biased by the information they may be provided. They think other people agree with them more than they do because that's what they know, so others must know the same thing. You tell somebody, here's a scale that's going to measure how social you are. You do the scale, so you're a very social person. Then they say, oh, no, what? We were just messing with you. It's an experiment. The scale means nothing. They still think they're more social than people who didn't take the scale. And then I think the only incentive compatible, meaning people get paid to be accurate, study that I know of. People know how a particular investment did perform, and they had to trade with people who didn't know that, and yet still in that system where they were being rewarded for being accurate, they were unable to put themselves in the shoes of the people who didn't know how the stocks were going to perform. Okay, so given all this, we would strongly predict in a real-world situation that people would not be able to undo the information they've received. And fortunately for me, Consumer Reports run a natural experiment unintentionally that allowed me to test that. So on January 5th of 2007, they come up with this story with a very scary imagery, and they come up with the new ratings for infant car seats. Okay, so this is it. This tells you on a bunch of variables, but basically black is bad and red is good, and most car seats are really bad, and even the best car seat, it's mediocre. Okay, and this rating was quite different from the rating they had for the same car seat just 2 years ago. The correlation of ranking is 0.14. The correlation of ratings, meaning this number right here, right, how good is it? It's essentially zero. Okay, so they basically randomized one of the two rankings, which is good, because usually it's very hard to get. So I'll show you, I'm getting ahead of myself. So on January 18th, just 13 days later, almost perfectly 2 weeks, they say, oops, we actually made a mistake. Please completely ignore the rankings we published 2 weeks ago. We outsourced the test to another company, and what we were trying to do is instead of running the test at 30 miles per hour, we told them to run it at 38 miles per hour and see what happens. And we thought that completely changed reality, right, going from rankings with a correlation that was basically zero. But actually, they ran at 70 miles per hour. And at 70 miles per hour is basically all randomness. It's all random, right? So one degree of difference is going to make a whole world of difference, particularly when you have a sample of one, right? So you crash one car seat once. So it's all random noise. And it was a big story. And even if you don't read Consumer Reports, even if you just read the newspaper, you would find out about this, right? So I'm going to be looking at what's the impact of this first the initial news and then the retraction on the market. You may worry, well, who pays attention to Consumer Reports? So I went to Newsbank, which is a database of newspapers, and I looked for stories that contain the word car seats and the word Consumer Reports. So nobody was talking about car seats and Consumer Reports until they did the press release. Then a lot of newspapers were talking about it. Then they stopped, and then when the retraction was also pretty much covered. So if let's suppose we saw that the market doesn't go back to where the way it was before, it's not because people didn't know about the retraction. That was my main concern at the time. And at this time, I didn't know. When I got this data, I didn't have the market data. So I had a really strong prior that the market was not going to go back, and I wanted to make sure that I could put aside alternative explanations for it, such as people not knowing about it. So how you test this? If I just look at a seller like Amazon, for example, the main problem is Amazon has, for the most part, fixed prices, and most other retailers have definitely fixed prices. So it'd be hard to see changes in demand. But eBay has a great feature that prices change every day. So it allows you to track how markets respond to news on a pretty much continuous basis. So I got eBay data. I have about 3,000 transactions, or auctions rather, for 5 different models of car seats. Right? So I needed car seats that were in both rankings to make the comparison. And the kind of analysis that I did, I ran regressions where because car seats differ quite a bit in terms of how expensive they are, I divided the price of each individual car seat that was sold by the average price of that car seat. And I tried to predict that with a bunch of covariates, controls, and the difference, the D rank, or drunk, is the difference in rank. Okay, the difference in ranking times the week. So we would expect if there was a change in ranking, but nobody knows about it, that shouldn't predict anything. The prediction is D rank times week is only going to be significant during the weeks in which the information was actually reported. And so this interaction is going to measure what's the percentage change in price of the car seat as a function of how many slots it drops, right? So the average is going to be per each slot that's dropped in the ranking. What's the price difference? So this is all the prices are standardized in week 5. Week minus 1 is the week before the rankings were revealed. On week 0, it's the first week when the information comes, so it starts on the first day. They dropped about 3% per slot. So if you dropped 3 slots, you would drop around 9%. Interestingly, this is pretty flat for the second week. And then when the information is retrieved or recalled, it goes back to normal almost immediately. Okay. So the only two significant differences from 0 are these 2 weeks. So statistically, at least, the eBay market fully was able to undo the information they had received, which was surprising to me. I wasn't expecting this to happen. Okay, so this is one example. To some extent, it's just a technical anecdote that I'm telling you, right? Just like any particular study is.
Yes. So undo after the retraction.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's why this is important here. It's not that people overreacted at the very beginning and then they went back to normal. During the second week, they were behaving just as they did the first week after the information came in, right? So how generalizable is this anecdote? So there's two main findings here. The first is of most interest to marketers, but I guess to this only to some extent, which is to what extent do consumers respond to safety ratings or to ratings of any kind? Usually that's really hard to test, because if I tell you, you know, the smart car is actually less safe than the Hummer, we all know that, even if Consumer Reports doesn't tell us that. So we can't really test what's the impact of Consumer Report when everybody shares that information. But if Consumer Reports is nice enough to give you random information, now we can test that. And so when they gave random information, the market responded. Hence, people really do respond to experts. But what I find, to what extent is that generalizable? So I think this is pretty much an extreme case, okay? Car seats are. Because people who are buying car seats, they tend to buy for the first child, and they have no prior experience. Just by looking at car seats, you have no intuition as to which one's better. And the only institution ranking car seats is the Consumer Reports. So we definitely would expect in this setting people to respond to experts. But the retraction, on the other hand, there was a lot of things working against it. So it's not that, what I'm saying, it's not that interesting that I found that consumers respond to Consumer Reports. What is more interesting is that they also respond to the retraction. And the reason is this: it's hard to find a more emotional item than an infant car seat. Right? So even if people understand it's no longer true that this was unsafe, it should still feel unsafe. And there's a lot of evidence that even once you know something, if you still feel that way, you respond accordingly. And you may think, well, okay, but there is still some information in the fact that that one car seat survived better a 70-mile-per-hour crash. You could argue it's random, but there might be some value in information. And also, I'm looking at auctions. I'm not looking... I actually will be able to look at more finer grain by looking at individual bids. But in the auction setting, we're looking at the price-setting bidder, the marginal bidder in economic terms. So we'd expect the marginal bidder to be more able to respond to information. So if the marginal bidder, that's pretty much a lower bound of what the rest could be doing. On the other hand, so everything points in this direction points to the fact that this is a lower bound to the extent that in other settings we should also be able to undo or retract information. Except that here, unlike the thousands of experiments have shown the opposite, memory plays almost no role. So almost all the experiments that find an effect that people cannot ignore information, it's in a situation where they have to remember the information afterwards. Here they can just say, okay, I'm going to toss this magazine and go back to the previous one. Okay, so as a general introduction after that particular paper, what I typically do is I take results that will be done with paper and pencil or in psychology experiments, and I try to see to what extent they have consequences for economic behavior in markets. And sometimes I just do paper and pencil studies myself. That's it.
Right, one of the objectives, of course, of doing research is to have an impact in the real world. So we've got a number of people here from companies that may actually be able to ship any interesting results we get. So we know that Mike Rowe from Microsoft Research, who can no doubt make use of any cool ideas we come up with. Mike.
Okay, I'll speak without slides. Firstly, as my laptop had a hard disk failure this morning, and secondly, it'll save me having to struggle with a projector for half an hour to get it working. So yes, I'm Michael Rowe. I work for Microsoft Research in Cambridge, UK, rather than Cambridge, England, rather than Cambridge, Massachusetts. As a sort of example of the kind of work I've been doing a project recently on security of online games and observing what people have been doing in the region of cheating, and defrauding each other and defrauding the game company. And so I've been trying to put together some ideas for what to do on a project with the psychologists, with applied psychologists. And the first problem I ran into was just explaining the really strange assumptions that are made in typical computer security research. Every academic field is like this. There are assumptions you make that kind of become so common you don't bother justifying them anymore in every research paper. And your new research students just forget that the world could have been any other different way. And then you come to do some cross-disciplinary work, and people go, what on earth, why are you assuming these completely mad things? So as an example, right, in computer security, there is an attacker, or at least there might be. It's a kind of fundamental thing about it being a piece of computer security research, that the system you're talking about is going to be attacked by somebody who's going to do some bad thing to it. And generally, if you're lucky, in the paper, there'll be something describing itself as threat model, where you try and describe what is this bad thing that you're trying to prevent the person doing, and what kind of means are they going to bring about to do it, in terms of money, expertise, willingness to use violence, etc. But when you look at these, they're strange in several ways. Firstly, they tend not to be empirically justified. I mean, there are good examples where there are measurements. Some things like Richard Clayton back at the University of Cambridge has been doing a lot of stuff on phishing websites where looking at what criminals are really doing. And some of the stuff I've been doing in online games has been measuring real instances of fraud and cheating. But often, in the literature, you'll see it's kind of a hypothetical attack. Well, somebody might do this with no even pretense of empirically justifying it, that, yes, they really are people who are trying to do this bad thing. And the second thing is it's usually technically unrealistic. As a way of explaining this, a realistic model of what an attacker can really do to the system is really difficult to model mathematically and really hard to prove theorems about. So what you have is these nice, simple definitions of the attacker that have a great benefit that mathematicians can prove theorems about them. And in some cases, you can just stop there. If you're a mathematician, you know, relationship to the real world is kind of neither here nor there. We can prove nice theorems, we're done. But if you want to be slightly less cynical than that, you can say some of these definitions, as long as they're strictly stronger than what the attacker can really do, we build a system that's secure against this very strong attacker that we can model mathematically. And that also means we'll be secure against attackers who are less strong. But the thing to note about this is we don't really think there are people who can do these things. You know, the kind of typical assumption from the Dolev-Yao paper is the attacker can monitor absolutely everything. In typical real situations of internet use, we don't really think there is an attacker who is monitoring every piece of network cable on the planet. So the assumptions we're making in the paper, we don't actually sort of really believe. And the second thing is that these attacker models are often, they're not sophisticated psychologically. The question of, you know, who is this attacker? Why do they want to do this bad thing? Is often totally outside the scope. You know, it's more a question of, if there was an attacker who wanted to do this thing, then here is the mechanism that protects against this. But we don't really think about it. And so a question that maybe what we should do when we're doing collaborative work is to not try to fix this. This may be okay. The things that are causing us the real grief are where we're making unrealistic assumptions about the person who uses the system rather than the attacker. Where we're assuming that people can remember long strings of numbers, or can look at 128-bit MD5 hashes on the screen and compare them against something on a piece of paper. Or all these other kinds of things that... these things where we were assuming that the user of the system, the one we're trying to help, can do something, and actually they can't. Those are a problem. The ones where we're being a bit optimistic about the attacker and assuming that people are trying to break into the system are actually better than they really are, maybe we can live with that as a limitation. But just a thing to note that when you read this literature, these assumptions, yeah, we know they're unrealistic and crazy. And I'll stop it. Stop it there.
Well, our final speaker for this session is James Randi, who may be known, at least by repute, many here. He had a long career as a stage magician, and he was entertaining us last night at the reception by making things appear and disappear, but he's also had a career since then as an investigator of the paranormal, of things that go bump in the night, and various other kinds of deception. James.
I appreciate that change of definition that you've given me. You referred to me, first of all, as a debunker. I am not a debunker, I'm an investigator, because being a debunker would imply that you go into an investigation saying, this is not so. I don't know, and I don't have any evidence, but it's just not so, and I'm going to prove it to be not so. That is not a scientific attitude, though I'm not a scientist. I try to adapt myself to the world of science. I try to adopt a scientific point of view where I look into something. I simply say to myself, I don't know. I think I'll try to find out. Now, it ends up being debunking. That's quite true. But that's not the intention from the beginning. You have to be honest about that. Now, despite the disparaging remark made about beards earlier, I shall continue, and I must point out that Bruce and I, though we're in some competition, he loses in comparison. So I am perhaps less trustworthy than Bruce, if that is a criterion, pardon me. Now, for this is a strange thing to get at, because I have a few topics here that I'm going to have to drop out because of the limited time. I normally speak for an hour and 20 minutes, followed by questions and answers when I speak at universities, colleges, whatever. So this is going to be rather hurried, but I'll try to get in as much as I possibly can. I would first of all call your attention to the room that surrounds us. Elegant room, very interesting in construction, but notice the holes. I tried to count them, but I gave up very soon. Why are they there? They are there in order to eat up sound, to make it difficult to hear someone speaking from this podium, for example. Now, Uri and Mike did pretty well. Some of the other folks, I'm sure that folks in the back, couldn't hear what they said at all. You've got to speak up when you're going to be heard and you don't have a microphone. I tried this microphone, but with the batteries, it simply doesn't work. Now, I don't know why. I haven't figured that out, but I'm working on it. I had an MRI not too long ago. They scanned my brain. My neurologist did that because I'm recovering from a double bypass. And doing very well, thank you. But I was astonished at what he was able to find out. First of all, this cavity here was not filled with methane, as many thought. There actually is a small hunk of gray jelly in there someplace, and it's connected up, perhaps loosely and perhaps and not too securely, but they did find all kinds of wonderful things. I am getting more and more fascinated on how the brain, this thing in our head, works. As a magician, I have a particular point of view on this subject. I have always maintained for years now that having a PhD doesn't necessarily make you smart. It only makes you educated. I know an awful lot of PhDs out there, and some of us in this room, I'm sure, know of them as well, who do not have great perception of the real world. The ivory tower syndrome is rampant all over the place. Now, for example, as a magician, and this is my peculiar expertise, my particular approach to life. As a magician, I don't walk out, and I always tell my students, oh, never walk out on stage, take a deck of cards from your pocket and say, I have here a perfectly ordinary deck of cards. No, never. What you're doing is you're introducing the possibility that it isn't a regular deck of cards. Instead, you take it from your pocket, and while you're talking to them, you break open the pack, you take out the pack itself, you take the cellophane from it, and without making any comments, you crumple that up, and you look through it, take out the jokers, toss them aside, and start to shuffle the deck of cards. They assume that it's a perfectly ordinary deck of cards. Now, you may be sitting here saying, well, not moi. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't assume. I need evidence. Wrong. For example, I have fooled all of you already. No, this is the real beard. Many people said to me, is that the real beard? This is the real one, because this is such a prestigious audience, I wouldn't wear one of the fakes. This is the real beard, so that's not where I deceived you. Where I deceived you is in the fact that I have no idea what you look like. Because I normally wear glasses, you see, spectacles. These are not spectacles. No, these are empty frames. Perfectly empty frames that I have been wearing, sitting at the table since 10 minutes past 9. I have continuously, and you may have noticed, I have taken them off, and I have done little things like flecking non-existent bits off them, and I've polished them, sat there, did this many times, and that sold to you It's sold to you. You didn't think of it. Oh, I see he's wearing real glasses with lenses in them. No, you didn't need to say that. You assume these were regular glasses, and they are not. The real glasses are here, and I will now place them on. Oh, my God, they're ugly. I had no idea. Now, this is a stunt that I use during my lectures before colleges as well, and it's always rather effective. I use another one with the microphone gag where I come out and I adjust the microphone, make all kinds of noise on it, and jack it down and then start speaking into the microphone, which is not connected at all. It's a wireless microphone that I'm using, and I walk away from the podium slowly, and you see people going, they're a little puzzled, because they assumed that I was using the microphone at the podium. Now, I used to have a game with Richard Feynman, the Nobel laureate in physics. What a lovely gentleman, and how much I miss him. The game was simply this. I would pull brain teasers on him every now and then, mind bogglers, on a surprise basis. It could happen any time at all. And he'd look at me, and some small miracle would occur, and he'd look around, and he'd say, oh, was that one of them? And I'd say, yes, it was. Now, the arrangement was that he could ask me any question about it, as long as the answer was yes, no, or doesn't apply. Feynman was a very well-educated and intelligent gentleman, but there are a few things he did not know. For example, he wasn't aware of the fact that the Earth rotated on its axis, obviously, because I lived in New Jersey at the time. He lived in Los Angeles, and he would call me at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I would say, but Richard, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. He said, no, it's not. You're on the other coast. Yes, Richard, you see, the Earth turns on its axis, as seen from the North Pole, in a counterclockwise direction. And he'd say, yes, 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 I know all that. Well, why don't you make use of that knowledge then? And then he'd say, well, in the restaurant the other day when you did the trick with me, if the waiter had come over and sat us near the window, would that have made any difference? And I'd say, no, Richard, it wouldn't. Ah, then that only leaves two possibilities. I'll call you back. Click. And I would say, hello. And then I'd lay awake for the rest of the night staring at the ceiling, wondering when he was going to call back, because he obviously hadn't taken the lesson about the Earth rotating. But it was an interesting game, and I had great joy in playing it. By the way, he never failed to solve any of the mysteries that I presented him. He would sometimes it would take several months, and finally he would narrow it all the way down to a certain point, and boom, he'd hit it. And I'd have to say, bingo, you got it. Now, most magicians, this may come as a revelation to you, it certainly does when I speak in front of groups of magicians, don't know why their tricks work. That's strange. They know they work because they've done them, and done them repeatedly, and sometimes they do things on stage that they don't quite understand, but they know that they work. That's a strange sort of a thing. It's something that I find hard to understand, because I, as a magician, have always, I believe, known how the tricks work. And yet, when I used to do cabaret work, I would walk out in front of an audience with the music playing from the very introduction that introduced me from backstage, and I'd walk out and do a 2-minute and 40-second routine with a piece of newspaper under my arm. I'm not about to do it. Don't be afraid that I'm going to start doing tricks. I would have it under my arm, and I would just look at the audience. The music would be playing away. I'd unfurl the newspaper. I'd tear it up into small pieces, down to about so big, and shuffle the pieces, and wink at them, and then give it a flip, and it would all be back together again. And I'd go through the newspaper this way and toss it aside. The music would stop, and I'd look at them and say, you know, I don't know how that trick's done, and I don't care. Now, that enabled me to do something that I wasn't aware of in the beginning. I started doing it, and I found it worked very well. But I only realized years into it that I was sizing up the audience. I would be looking around the audience while tearing up the newspaper and seeing people who were paying attention and others that maybe had a few too many drinks, or they were distracted in some way, and be talking to the person beside them. But this kind of, I don't want to talk to that kind of person. I don't want them on stage, certainly, but I would finally end up at the end of this trick with this person and that person. Those are the two I'm going to ask to come on stage to assist me. Not because they go along with things, but because they would be cooperative in that if I asked them to take seats, they would do it and not say why or some such thing. Now, these are unconscious things that magicians do themselves. Many magicians don't know how their magic works. Now, there is a distinct difference between the magician, the conjurer is the better term that I prefer. The English use that. A magician would be someone who actually has control of nature and subverts nature in some such way, makes the laws of the universe not work. Well, I don't do that. I frankly admit that, you see. I'm quite honest with you. I don't subvert nature. I actually use trickery. But the difference between the people that I expose, not debunk, but expose eventually as a result of investigations and having evidence presented to me, those people are the people who lie to the public. They feed on the grieving and the vulnerable, people who have lost relatives or loved ones or whatever, and want to know if they can talk to the dead. Oh, I too can talk to the dead. I think Shakespeare said something to that effect. I too can speak to the dead, but when I speak, talk to the dead or whatever, do they answer? I've read Hotspur someplace, Henry the something or other, I don't know. But it's in there in Shakespeare. Look it up. Google will know. Google knows everything, as we all know. Now, I once did a television program, a series, I should say, in England for Granada TV. I was called James Randi, Psychic Investigator. I hate that title because it implies that I might be psychic, you see. No. An investigator of psychics would have been much better, but they insisted on that. It's like another series I did for George Slaughter of Real People years ago. He said it was called Magic or Miracle. That's like saying magic or magic. But he wasn't aware of that, and I couldn't fight him on it. There was a woman named Maureen Flynn who appeared, a gorgeous redhead, tall, very statuesque, and very, very effective. She did what we call in the trade cold reading. Cold reading is a business of throwing out things like, I'm getting the impression of someone with a name starting with B or D. Now, why the ghost, the shade, if you will, of my father-in-law would come back to me through a spirit medium and say, my name starts with B or D. I really can't figure out. Is this 20 questions? Yes, it is 20 questions. In fact, it's 60 or 80 questions. It's the old game of guessing. But Maureen Flynn came with credentials that you wouldn't believe. One gentleman appeared there. He's the one who introduced her to me, and he had with him an audio cassette. He said, this is a 40-minute recording of what she told me. She was able to identify the name of my deceased wife, Doris. And I said, really? Well, I took the tape and I made a transcript of it. I wrote it out carefully. And I had it with me when he appeared in front of the cameras on Granada TV. And I said, do you consider this to be a miracle of some kind that she was able to come up? Oh, yes, yes, how would she know? And she just said it like that, Doris. And it was correct. Now, she didn't have any chance to do any research on me. This is the day before Google, if you can imagine a day before Google. But there was a time in history where Google didn't exist, you see. Now, she couldn't have done that. And I thought, that's remarkable. But after listening to the tape and making the transcript, I was well armed. I said to him, very simply, how many other names did she guess? And he said, no, no other guesses, just Doris. I said, really? Took a piece of paper, and I read from it. 17 names that she had come up with, and he stood there with his arms folded. This is the attitude you really like. Nope, 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 nope. Saying all the way through, nope, nope, nope. He didn't remember the 17 names. He only remembered Doris, and she never said Doris. She said, there's a woman, an elderly woman, standing behind you. Who do you suppose that might be? And he said, that must be my wife, Doris. He's the one who said Doris. She never did. Now, this is astonishing when you do this kind of research and you find these are the facts. And the gentleman in question, who I was trying to help to understand this, took this sheaf of papers from me and threw it on the floor. And he said, I don't care what that says. I know what she did. Now, I will not name a lady in this country who's very well, very, very well known to you. She's a lady who appears on the media very, very frequently, on television. And she once recited something that Uri Geller, the spoon bender, oh, there's an art for you. I can bend a spoon. Really? Duh. Who cares? It has not moved mankind forward one iota. Not even a demi-iota. Is there such a thing? I'm sure there is someplace. Spoon bending. There's an art. He actually bent this TV presenter's key, not spoon, key on her keychain. She handed it to me. She said, now, Randi, tell me how that was done. And I said, well, do you have a have a working one. This is all bent. She gave me a bent. Well, I ended up bending it by surreptitious means, trickery, skullduggery, all of those things and such. And she said, but Geller never touched the key. I said, really? I almost said her name, pardon me. And we went to the video room afterwards. Now, this is a woman who at that time was paid, and still paid, millions of dollars by her network in order to appear on television as a competent reporter, right? We stood there and watched. I said, Geller had the key for 1 minute and 40 seconds. She said, no, he never touched the key. Believe me, I was there, Randy, you weren't. But I saw the program, you see, which was broadcast. At one point, she put the key on the table. Geller reached across, and I started the stopwatch. Click. And she said, well, I didn't say he never touched it. I said, yes, you did. You said he never touched it. Well, I meant that he didn't handle it. Geller took the key, looked at it, dropped his hand below the table, with both hands together below the table, and said to her, how long have you had this key? And she said, oh, I've had it for several years now. And at that point, turned to the camera and said, we'll be back right after these commercial announcements. Screen went black, stayed black, and I'm sitting there with the stopwatch, and she's looking at me and saying, well, I didn't mean that he didn't touch it or that he didn't hold it. I meant, no, that's exactly what she had said on the program. Now we were off the air, of course. I clicked it when he came up above the table with the key, took her hand and pressed it into her hand and closed her hand on it so she hadn't seen it, and turned her hand face down like that on the table. And I went, click, 1 minute and 40 seconds on the nose. Now, this is astonishing that a person like this, with this ability and duty to report the facts as they are, could do such a thing. Now, I have a product here that you have probably seen. How many, and let's see a show of hands. This is not your hand. This is showing your hand, okay? How many people here have presented, say, a $50 bill perhaps in a restaurant, and they've had the cashier reach into the drawer and take out a pen like this to test the bill? Let's see hands. Oh, my goodness, culture is a mock here. This is called the counterfeit detector pen. It has it has a patent number on it. The U.S. Patent Office has patented this, ladies and gentlemen, so it must work, right? Well, they take the... Now, I haven't got time to do the whole demonstration here, but I use a print-up on newsprint. I print a fake bill, you see, usually part of a comic strip on the back. And I show this to my university audiences, and I say, make a mark there. And it says on the pen that if the mark shows up black, well, that's very suspicious, yeah? That means it's counterfeit. If it shows up amber, it's perfectly all right. Now, here's a regular piece of paper, all right? I'm going to make a mark on this piece of paper. What color would you say that is, sir?
Black.
Black. Oh, very good judgment. Thank you, sir. It's good to have good assistants, you know, and qualified people with authority, you see. That's black. Yes, it is. Now, here's a piece of newsprint. Look at that. What color would you say that is?
That's amber.
Very good. Good decisions. Ladies and gentlemen, I present this counterfeit bill printed on newsprint because there's no starch in newsprint, you see, but there is starch in this paper. Sizing, they call it, and it makes it easier to handle in printers, makes it easier to handle in many ways. And it's not a fake. They're not trying to fool you in any way. But the patent office, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, issued a patent to this device because the claim was, in the patent papers, that counterfeiters use cheap paper. Wait a minute. You're going to increase the value of a piece of paper from nothing to $100, and you don't mind that markup, do you? I mean, look, there's a considerable markup in the product. Does this make sense? The U.S. Patent Office patents perpetual motion machines, free energy machines, every year. Now, is that deception? No, it's ignorance. The examiners don't know what they're doing. There are endless perpetual motion machines that are patented on the theory that every American has the right to have a patent. I don't think that that's a correct theory at all. Now, I'll give you an example from the magic trade, from my experience, and then I must close my tirade, a talk. There was, when I was a kid, a teenager, about 14 or so, I went to the Casino Theater in Toronto, Canada, where I was born and almost raised. And he was a Chinese magician, that I didn't hear of since that time. As a matter of fact, I've looked him up in the history books, and I don't find him anywhere. I can't remember his name right off the top of my head, but he was a moderate-sized gentleman dressed in beautiful Chinese robes and constantly changing them. He had statuesque assistants on the stage, and he had a bit of a limp, and it wasn't much of a limp. It was a sort of a kind of a thing. It wasn't much, and he could manage very well with it. We noticed it from the very beginning. He came out on stage. He was doing these wonderful manipulations with bowls of water and goldfish flying everywhere. It was a wonderful, wonderful act. And the finale was really something else to see. He appeared on stage, changed his costume right on stage, put on a big headpiece that covered his face completely, put on gloves, and the other assistants on the stage, they also changed into these weird costumes, looking like a Chinese parade of some kind, I imagine. And though I'm not an expert on Chinese parades, I admit. And they moved around on the stage and went through all kinds of dance steps and whatnot, into boxes and out of boxes and such. And at the finale, he and the statue, whoop, I'll be all right, keep your seats. The statuesque blonde lady that he had with him, dressed in this costume with the headpiece on so they couldn't be recognized, held hands with them and walked down towards the front of the stage, down towards the footlights. And it went. He walked down like this, and he was taking bows, and they were applauding, and suddenly he straightened up. And she took on the limp. They took off the headpieces. That was him. This was her. That limp was totally phony. When I met him in the alley afterwards, not threateningly at all, just to say hello and identify myself, it was wonderful to see, because he didn't have a limp, unless he was on stage. That was put on all the way through the show just for the finale. Now, that's pretty damn clever. You got to admit, we magicians are cunning folks. But there are politicians and lawyers and all kinds of other folks out there as well who do exactly the same kind of thing. And I am appalled by the fact that, for example, the Wall Street Journal recently ran an article saying about psychic phenomena. They ran it on the internet version. Of course, it's not possible to evaluate paranormal claims. Get out of here, friends. It's very possible, and we do it at the James Randi Educational Foundation each and every day of our existence. And we do it with great aplomb, and we do it very successfully. We don't debunk. We simply investigate, and we're able to prove in many cases that these people are liars, fakes, frauds, and vultures. We offer a $1 million prize. Available to each and every one of you if you'd like to come forward and claim it. It's not my money, so I don't care. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for the use of the theater. Thank you.
Well, thanks for that, James. We've set 15 or 20 minutes to starting, so what I propose to do is we set the morning's program by that much, which will give us 15 to 20 minutes of questions to the panel.
I have a question for James Randi.
Uh-oh.
I know you're very familiar with Darwin Putoff.
Oh, yes.
SRI.
The Laurel and Hardy of Psi, I call them.
Yeah, okay,
yes.
That's good. Did you ever meet Ed Meng?
Oh, yes.
Good. Last time I talked with Ed, he was talking about something that would be of great interest to this group, which was the use of massive error-correcting codes to try and demonstrate that even in a very noisy channel, a psychic phenomenon could be demonstrated scientifically. I wonder what you ever, I know you're yawning, but I just wonder what you ever run into that.
No, I have not, although I've run into it, generally speaking, all kinds of complicated computer programs and very esoteric ways of finding whether or not people can tell the future. That's not difficult. You don't need computer science to do this. You know, tell me. What's going to happen? Did any of the major psychics, any of them, even the minor psychics, predict 9/11? Not one of them. Not one of them. That's a major event in history, not only for us, for the world. And not one of them predicted it. Oh, they'll predict it. Sylvia Brown all the time predicts who the presidential candidates are going to be and who's going to win. Now, she is so wrong that if you want to find out who's going to win the coming election, find her prediction, it'll be exactly the opposite. And that's very dependable because she has a wonderful record in that particular respect.
Thank you. Yes, Frank.
It's great to the first speaker, but I'm a sociologist, and in our area, we're always very suspicious, sometimes too suspicious, of any kind of modeling of behavior, any attempt to work out tools and instruments that can anticipate reactions. And one of the things that I have that I've noticed talking to, for example, people involved in security in relation to suicide bombings in other areas, the point they always make to me is that when they've done the investigation, there is no sort of obvious pattern there. Because a lot of Israelis I've talked to make the point that the suicide bomber is not at all like the caricature version that we have of that. And quite often talking to people involved in security within Britain, the point that they make is that very often their kind of anticipated model for no relationship to the actual event. It's not to say that models aren't particularly important, but my question as a sociologist, what I'm particularly worried about, isn't there a danger that by the usage of modeling or having certain instruments, which we then sort of provide to people on the ground, they actually can end up de-skilling individuals involved in security-related areas, where gradually they begin to use their professional judgment, and gradually they begin to lose their intuition by relying far too much on what the statistics say or what people have said beforehand? It seems to me potentially is a huge problem in the security setting, where a lot of individuals, especially lower down the chain, stop thinking for themselves and basically, you know, sort of rely on kind of cut-out models.
I really have done no work on suicide bombing, and because I don't have a security classification, whatever little bit of data exists, I can't even find that. So I have to take that off the table. All I've read is probably what you've read in the magazines and books that suggest this very heterogeneous group that's changing. However, in regards to the issue of intuition versus informed judgment, I sometimes refer to myself as the envy of intuition. I think this intuition is the refuge of stereotypes. And we have tested over 12,000 people in the law enforcement. Most of them are law enforcement, some of them are security, some are psychiatrists, lawyers, VAs. We have tested college students. And they're really close to chance, but have high confidence in their abilities.
In terms of
being able to tell from someone's demeanor whether they are asleep. It's there's a lot of stereotypes. There are a lot of people who pervade stereotypes. One of the largest trainers for the Army pervades, made by the Army, stereotypes about the left up to the left or the left up to the right. That will say whether or not it's wrong. But racial stereotypes, dress stereotypes, we have some social psychological data suggest you're a little overweight or if you have an unusual face or if you have a scar, people are more likely to think that you're wrong. So I start with an assumption here, we're better off people who at least know what's the basis of the judgment they're making and be hyper alert to the stereotypes that we're all holding.
Isn't it a case that a lot of people on the ground have professional experience, and therefore what you call intuition may well be highly educated?
No, because we also have data, this is published, and if you write to me, I'll send you three articles on it, that years of experience is not a predictor. It's only a predictor of the firmness of confidence and certainty. You don't get feedback. Here we have over 200 people from the Innocence Project who have been exonerated. Where they were waiting for either life imprisonment or death row, and DNA evidence or some other evidence, mostly DNA, showed they didn't do it. Is it because the policemen were malevolent? No. But they made a mistake of a variety of kinds, but they don't get the feedback in time to learn from mistakes. That's the biggest problem in law enforcement, is that when you make a mistake, you don't get the feedback if you make a mistake.
Charles, a question for Jim. There's a lot of diverse evidence from different areas that information generally doesn't affect people's behavior very much. It's like food labeling, for example, the National Food Labeling Act had no impact on people's diet, at least as far as research is concerned. confidence that something like this can change behavior?
Well, I would very much like to do attacks against people who are using the cube to find out if they respond differently. I do know that, like you said, it will increase confidence in their actions, and so it is true that the worst case is that it makes people more certain of their actions, even when their actions may be flawed. In an elder population, is that necessarily a bad thing to get them online, to get them active? Are we doing actual harm is your question. I would like to try to test this more thoroughly to determine if we could do harm, and I think that that's clearly the next experiment step.
But is that going to end up, if information doesn't make a difference, maybe what we should be doing is protecting people's privacy for them, because they think we can't rely on them to protect it for themselves. But by putting this cube on the table, is that kind of a cop-out on the part of the information security community?
I do not think that the baseline protection of privacy is in any way adequate online. I think that, we literally still have, excrement in our food supply. We thought we solved that problem 100 years ago when we forced people to sell only milk that was labeled as milk. And we had a very serious regulatory problem that we're still struggling with to make sure that people sell as food only that which you can eat as food. So I think that the baseline is, in a word, shameful. The amount of information that is grabbed and utilized, and the inability of individuals to protect themselves. And certainly the security community has some responsibility for pushing that and making people aware of that. But at the same time, I think an informed decision is better than an uninformed decision. And if you have that information about where you've been, about where your friends have been, about whether or not this is a bank, if you choose not to act in a more informed manner from that decision, that is different from saying, you could have this information, but we're not going to give it to you. And if I could send you, if you wanted to provide feedback and experiment design, I would speak.
Thinking about the padlock in web browsers, it's telling you something very subtle. But the first thing that goes wrong is people don't look at it at all. But the second thing is telling you something very subtle. It's telling you that the domain name matches the certificate, not that you're not talking to a fraudster. So I'm sort of suited to some people who have been doing the actual fraud side, but often the fishers who are trying to steal your bank account details will get themselves a certificate, so you get that gateway padlock there. But this is okay, but in fact, it's not talking to a criminal. So I somewhat worry about this red growing cube is exactly what means that this cube has gone red or green. Because often we're building things where the security indication is something very unintuitive and very subtle that is unreasonable.
Okay,
briefly.
Okay. The reputation system depends on two trusted sources of information, the FDIC and the National Credit Union Association. Otherwise, it depends upon your temporal history and the temporal history of your constrained social network, and it depends upon the fact that phishing sites need to go up and they come down quickly, and you can't get a positive rating unless you've existed for more than a week. So, yes, I love Richard Clayton's phone calls.
I have a
virtual
question.
Yeah, I was curious about you. Story of someone I knew who took one of these polygraphs, and the woman who was doing the interview started off by saying, oh, there's only two types of people that really have trouble with this, mathematicians and engineers. Of course, he said, well, great, I'm both. But, and then I think she elaborated a little bit this was because, of the sort of cognitive load of the thing that they try and be too precise. But I was wondering if there's any basis to that, or maybe she said that just to almost to put him off balance. I don't know.
I strongly suspect, but I don't think there's any data, that the higher the IQ, the easier it is to beat the polygraph. There were training programs run in York during the Soviet period to train people. I tried very hard to get the government to allow that and ask for funds, just to train people to do the polygraph and then apply for security clearance jobs, but they said they didn't want to find out. I think it's a beatable system. But you know, that doesn't mean that there are unbeatable systems. Generally, there's more interest in investing money and finding out something that works, and then finding out, is there a way to beat the something that you've invested the money in? That seems like a less attractive investment.
Well, I suppose in our field, we've got a lot of experience of the value of hostile evaluation.
On this issue of what symbols mean, which is one of my particular interests, it's interesting that you brought up the padlock, because the padlock has actually changed in its meaning. It now means, as we just said, it now means you've got a certificate. But it started out meaning that you were using encrypted communications, and it replaced two keys which went together or stayed apart. And when they changed the symbol of it, this was across the browser, this was not an actual Microsoft thing or anything, they changed it across the browsers, what the symbol was. And I thought that was a very bad change of symbol, because the two keys told you something. It told you specifically, this is encrypted communication. But padlock actually tells you something different. It tells you, oh, this is secure. And I'm very worried that we use things like a padlock to say, look, this is a certificated site, because that's not what a padlock means to be. Right? So I'm very concerned about you saying, well, there's that, these are the symbols. But we're not looking at the semantics that people attach to these sorts of symbols and whether they're getting the right thing out of the symbology we're presenting.
I do not think I have the penultimate final solution. I think that I agree completely. And we started out, and the colors are problematic too, but I will stand on my assertion that nobody likes colors.
Who likes what?
Growing up. My whole growing up.
Well, I'm just, this is a very quick comment. It seems to me that the point of the orb or the cube, is to train the user to the importance of a symbol without binding it to the semantics, so that in fact smart people behind the scenes can enrich the semantics over time. If you think the padlock has a specific technical meaning and you're not going to change the technical meaning, you've actually misunderstood, I think, and I'd love to get a reaction to this, the right way to present a symbol to consumers, because what you really want to give them is a symbol of safety. We are the ones who ought to be helping them understand the right semantics, translating them into something. We can teach them how to read the symbol. We can change the structure of the determinations under it over time. Presumably, once you've got them to understand what it's supposed to be conveying.
Gene, as well, it seems to be mostly what Bruce said at the beginning. You're talking about security theater, aren't you? Not security. Maybe
you
people think something is secure, whether it is or not. The bank is secure because it looks secure, whereas the check cashing place is not secure. It may well be that that's not the case. Maybe it's safer at the check cashing place than the bank.
So what I want to communicate is this a place you've been before? Is this a place that's
making more secure. You're making it more secure.
Well, I mean, I have
people
an underlying reputation.
They may be right, of course.
Yeah, that I've also worked on, and it could be that it's fundamentally flawed, and but I've used the best available data in designing it.
So what you're basically trying to do is draw the distinction between the empty car park with Lorne in it and the bustling square with many people in it by saying that this client appearances, which are totally deceptive online. This is a site to which 3 million people went in the last month, and this is a site that was established 4 minutes ago when you were the first visitor. That's essentially what we're trying to build out.
Exactly. I'm trying to give them some sense of how populated it is temporally and socially, and whether or not there's an armed guard standing there.
Matt?
So, Gene, I'm wondering, and I'm not sure about this, but I wonder if the main problem with your cube, not orb, is that it ever glows and ever indicates that this is secure. I wonder if, you know, when we look at a phishing site, if the little padlock is there, it's in fact accurately telling us that we have a secure connection to the certified phishing site. You know, all of the security technology is working correctly. You know, it seems that we could be a little more sophisticated about making those decisions, but as we do so, it becomes more difficult to know what they actually mean. Maybe this idea that we should be giving people a user experience that tells them whether they're secure or not, you know, is an inherently impossible task, and what we should really be doing is educating people that there isn't a way to tell from the browser or from the environment that something is secure or not. And to do so is analogous to, you know, blaming my eyeglasses for the fact that liars don't glow red when I'm looking at them. You know, maybe we're chasing the wrong thing here.
And it's interesting that users are very much alike. Now, we did it on an undergraduate dorm, so they're very alike. And they're very strong sub-communities. And we don't know if they correlate with social networks, but we do know that if you include history information, it will glow green a lot, quite frequently. What are we telling them? Well, one of the things we tried to do to the design is not to tell them anything except for this is green or this is red. We don't tell them, give them your social security number. We don't tell them this is a good place to buy shoes. You know, no offense, in this room of everybody, I only want to know where Angela bought shoes. You know, we leave the contextual decision to the individual and just try to give them an indicator. Because there are certainly empty car parks that I'd feel comfortable walking into.
Well, I think we should probably go informal at this point. So I think this is a good panel to kick things off with, because it's shown us the enormous range of topics involved in the reception, directed to personal aspects, to distraction, to context, to prior knowledge that we have, to systems engineering, and how we can go about something.